Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley. Now, most global businesses enter Asia with a playbook built elsewhere. The pricing models, growth assumptions, labor structures, and definitions of value that worked in North America or Europe get applied to markets that operate by fundamentally different rules. The result? As Eric Streisand has observed across nearly two decades of an on-the-ground leadership work in Asia, is failure. Not dramatic failure, but the slow erosion of credibility that comes from never truly understanding where you are. Eric Streisand is Managing Director at the Global Institute for Tomorrow, or GIFT, an independent pan-Asian think tank with offices in Hong Kong and Kuala Lumpur. He has designed and facilitated more than 60 experiential leadership programs across 15 countries in Asia and the Middle East, working with over 3,000 executives from organizations including HSBC, Petronas, Marriott, MasterCard, and Standard Chartered. His public sector clients include the Hong Kong SAR government, the Dubai government, and the Central Bank of Malaysia. In this episode, Eric argues that much of what organizations believe they know about Asia is filtered through AI systems, research, and analysis shaped by Western institutions and historical precedents. Even conventional online research surfaces insights produced predominantly by incumbent Western policy and academic bodies, reinforcing a narrow and often distorted lens. Challenging these assumptions, he contends, requires moving beyond secondhand analysis and grounding decision-making in on-the-ground observation and lived experience. From renegotiating what value means to understanding why Western growth models break down in Asia's diverse political and social contexts, Eric offers a rare perspective on what it actually takes to operate credibly in a post-Western, Asia-led growth environment. Enjoy.
You know, I was in China about a month ago working on an aging healthcare, elderly healthcare, aging tech. And we were with a client who was a leading insurance company, and they were trying to understand the market for long-term care insurance and how to position a long-term care insurance program in a multi-generational fashion. And one of the blind spots, again, was not understanding the extent to which the Chinese government had already provided baselines of care. And then the market for private insurance is quite difficult. How do you attract the high net worths and the mass affluent? And then can you go any further? It's very competitive. So I think there was a lot of assumptions and surprise about the extent to which China actually is taking care of the problem.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Eric, welcome to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks, Todd. Happy to be here.
Okay, let's kick it off and let's start strong. And let's start with that core premise of your work. Now, you argue that much of what organizations believe they know about Asia is filtered through AI systems, research, analysis, shaped by Western institutions and perspectives. What's wrong with that approach? And why does it fail businesses trying to operate in Asian markets?
Well, let's be clear. The dilemma of really understanding people, understanding markets, policy, society, that dilemma didn't start with AI when we got ChatGPT a couple of years ago. It's been there and it's been pervasive in all sorts of media. So this is not, in my view, an essential question about how the algorithm and how the AI is delivering. It's more a fundamental ideological question of how we are interpreting the information that we get? And to what extent are we critically examining it, thinking hard, challenging and questioning our assumptions, and then ultimately also going and seeing with our own eyes and speaking to people who are on the ground, who are trusted colleagues or partners. So indeed, I think AI systems have made the whole conundrum slightly more complicated, and we risk outsourcing and offloading our critical thinking to the bots. And that would, of course, compound the situation, but it didn't start there. And I think, you know, I've been writing letters to the FT for years, challenging some of the core assumptions. Sometimes they even print them, and that's to their credit. Now I find myself arguing with Claude if he sends me stuff that is very distorted and I'm looking for something more balanced. So it's just changed.
It has. It's funny you mentioned that. I argue with AI a lot. I feel like I'm teaching it oftentimes more than it's teaching me.
Well, you should be getting paid by the plot, by the model.
Right. Because you're contributing to its intelligence.
Yeah.
It's such a yes, man. That's the thing that bothers me so much. And I've gone into the background, as I'm sure you have, and tried to adjust the parameters and how it speaks to me and how it's, you know, how thoughtful it is. Boy, if you don't wind that guy down and ask him to be a little bit more succinct, it just drones on and on and on.
Well, there's a stylistic, you know, you don't want it to be sycophantic. You don't want it to be so verbose that, you know, you waste all your time. But what the argument that I'm making is that much of the source material that it is drawing from, it's deriving from the training data, the media, the English speaking internet, and that in itself is still extremely biased and limiting.
Yeah, it's flawed. I mean,
and flawed.
It is still producing an answer or assumptions based on data, whatever you want, from flawed original sources that contributed or uploaded or put that on the internet, and it is just simply parsing what's there. And I wish that AI had its own level of critical thinking and distrust of information that it was being presented.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll get there. I think it's inevitable that there will be, you know, new tools and adaptations, and you can kind of tune the models for more or less critical thinking, challenging our assumptions and whatnot. But again, I think none of that is going to be as effective unless there are ways of actually deriving core data and insights from the ground. And I don't know that that's going to be something that digital and AI systems are going to be able to capture anytime soon, because it's messy and it's the world is unstructured, so to speak.
Yeah, completely. You talk about moving from abstract models to ground truth. Can you give us a concrete example of where you've seen a Western business model or assumption just completely break down when applied in an Asian market?
Well, there are many examples. And of course, some of the more colorful ones take place on projects that we work on in remote places, but not even that remote, peri-urban, where there's lack of services, and, you know, rural areas, which are not too far outside of, you know, Hanoi, outside of Surabaya in Indonesia, or any of the megacities in South Asia, et cetera. I was with a group last year looking at remote healthcare solutions. And we were working with a very prominent foundation NGO that raises money to build and operate floating hospitals. And first, the idea of a floating hospital is, like you just did, a little bit of a surprise for most people when they hear that. But the reality is that in Eastern Indonesia, you know, there's something like 20 to 30 million people who live on islands that don't have a clinic or a hospital in less than, you know, almost a full day of travel or more. And that's simply by the nature of the infrastructure challenge, the logistics challenge. The economics don't work out to build facilities in remote places. So anyway, core assumption, the group came in and said, it's obvious that telehealth needs to be part of this, right? You have volunteer doctors who would come and spend time on the boats. You have pharmaceutical companies who donate pharmaceutical medicines. Yeah, there are actually very sophisticated equipment outfitted on these boats, which are essentially barges, large barges with hospital inpatient, outpatient, even surgery. However, as it turns out, the internet signal is only on for an hour or so a day, and in certain regions on the island that we visited in Raja Ampat, which is in West Papua. So the entire assumption of, you know, delivering telehealth, telemedicine services breaks when the infrastructure is not there. And interesting, when we were there, they were already negotiating with Starlink to try to get coverage in some of these remote parts of Raja Ampat at West Papua, which, by the way, is one of the premier dive sites in the world. So if you're a diver or your listeners are divers, they may have heard of Raja Ampat. But of course, on the periphery, I mean, the citizens who live there are existing without a lot of the basic infrastructure.
I mean, we've seen this before. I even say it, I think, in the outro to this podcast, where, you know, there's a lot of ships that have gone to the bottom of the ocean, crashing on the shores or the cliffs of Asia, as far as trying to build and deliver there. And we've seen it with Google. We've seen it with Facebook. And we know that although a problem that you think would eat up and be really aggressive towards your solution, it just doesn't work because the problem on the outset might look the same, but it is so fundamentally different, culturally nuanced, that the Western solution just doesn't work.
There's so many. I think you know well, we were talking ahead of the recording here on the ride hailing apps. And when Uber and Grab went head to head in Southeast Asia, I don't presume to know all the details, but simply the socioeconomics, the urban structures, the motorbike penetration, the whole way of doing the business is completely different. And in China as well, I think. Of course, there's the policy and the preference for local providers in China as well. You know, I was in China about a month ago working on an aging healthcare, elderly healthcare, aging tech. And we were with a client who was a leading insurance company. And they were trying to understand the market for long-term care insurance and how to position a long-term care insurance program in a multi-generational fashion. And one of the blind spots, again, was not understanding the extent to which the Chinese government had already provided baselines of care. I think there's an insurance product called Huimingbao, which is actually kind of that urgent care or emergency care insurance that everybody can sign up to at a very low cost. And then the market for private insurance is quite difficult. How do you attract the high net worths and the mass affluent? And then can you go any further? It's very competitive. So I think there was a lot of assumptions and surprise about the extent to which China actually is taking care of the problem, therefore narrowing the space for private insurers. And then secondly, and I'll finish, the community infrastructure, which offers a wide range. This was in Shanghai, so it's, of course, one of the more affluent areas. But even, I think, in tier two and tier three cities, you find analogous community centers that take care of elderly in the community during the day. There's special dementia related care centers. And so there's a lot of resources that I think this group in particular was surprised to find and therefore had to recalibrate their assumptions around the role that they might be able to play.
It's so true. You struck a chord with me. Both my parents have dementia. They're in care homes. But, you know, even going back to the Uber, you know, the Uber Didi in China, that was another. And remarkably, Uber is a success story by escaping with what they came with in the deal that they did with Didi Dacha to actually get out. It was almost a one-to-one, and you almost never saw that. Right. But, you know, there's just so many case stories. Look what Disney had to do to even get into Shanghai and that deal they had. They gave up 80% of that place to the Chinese to be able to exist there. And then it was completely dialed and differentiated. Now, you mentioned that businesses must negotiate all core assumptions about value, growth, efficiency, and labor. So let's break those down. Let's start with the value. How do Asian consumers and businesses define value differently than what Western companies typically assume? Value.
I don't know that value from a consumer point of view is all that different. I think what is usually missed is the socioeconomic and development backdrop, which influences how consumers see value and how they make decisions. And the reality is that there's, you know, very large percentages of populations, particularly in Southeast Asia and South Asia, who are still lacking the basics that we have taken for granted for generations, several generations in North America and Europe. And of course, that's going to influence notions of spending versus saving. It's going to influence notions of what's valuable and how regularly people want to change and buy something new. There's been, of course, many attempts at trying to address this, even going back 20 years, the so-called fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, the classic work by C.K. Prahlad. And there are innovations that have come out of that, but there's also been many problems. And the classic problem, the innovation that went from, you know, a Harvard Business School case study to an environmental disaster is the single use, multi-material sachet. So the idea that a consumer should be able to buy a shampoo packet in a sachet as a one-off, and then no one thought about the fact that that material is almost impossible to recycle, and without collection systems, almost impossible to even collect and keep out of the environment. So we've done a lot of work on plastic waste, plastic circularity, recycling, mechanical, chemical. And those sachets are really the only thing you can do with them is burn them or chemically recycle them, which is very expensive. So value, I think, has to be seen in the wider context. Of course, much of Asia has been getting rich, but I think the problem many people make is assuming that there is something called Asia that has any consistency apart from, you know, a geographic continuum. And you almost can't relate, you know, notions of value or consumer activity behavior in Tokyo with, you know, Delhi or Jakarta. The context is so different.
Like Germany and France. I mean, people might, if you don't think they're the same, then obviously you can't even come close to thinking that. And I think it's even more diverse in Asia.
Far more. I know there's differences in Germany and France, but I think there's been a shared understanding, even if not agreement, but you know, a neighborhood and across cross border familiarity, customs, cross borders in Europe is not, well, of course, we can get into the debate. But I think the distance and the cultural proximity, you know, is far greater across the broader Eurasian landmass. Let's put it that way.
One thing I'll say on value in a very tiny microcosm is the feeling that consumers want to have in Asia. And I think it's pretty across the board, not everywhere, but that they got a deal. That is something quite particular, where it's less about price and more about the value is associated. And it is socioeconomic for sure, but they do always want to feel like they got a deal. That is something a little more pertinent to Asia.
Maybe, but it's, I think, also a function of the modern economic system that we've all learned. I mean, who doesn't want a deal? I think that's a psychological principle that marketers have used from the onset of marketing and selling. Again, I think that what is not understood broadly is population pressure, resource pressure, and the low starting point of development that countries like India, Indonesia, Philippines have come from. China also came from a very low base, but they are a remarkable example of what can be accomplished when there is vision and directive from the top. There is broad unity around the direction, and there is, you know, many, many layers of people being on board, both public and private sector. But what I'm suggesting is, of course, there are consumer values. People want a good deal. People, you know, want to feel financially secure. But the pressures in much of South and Southeast Asia are far different than we've ever experienced in North America.
Okay, let's talk about growth. Western businesses often bring a scale fast and dominate markets mentality. How does that assumption need to be renegotiated when going to Asia?
Well, China is the best counterpoint to that, which has utilized a quantity to quality approach. Whereas I think particularly with technology in North America and Europe, the assumption has been to kind of perfect a solution, create something that is differentiated and valuable and workable, and then scale it up. Whereas China has kind of flipped that on its head, again, given the advantage that it has with large populations and the creation of pilot kind of test zones, which are also in themselves very large. They can roll things out to, you know, tens of millions of people, get feedback, iterate, and then create a quality product based on that before scaling it up. And I think this happens on many levels. Last year, we were working with agricultural SMEs in Sichuan province. And just talking about the development trajectory, it was remarkable that going back 4 or 5 years, maybe in some cases closer to 8 to 10 years, some of these small businesses were literally the recipients of poverty alleviation funds. And that was during the whole, you know, poverty, eradicating absolute poverty drive. And now they had grown up, they had become successful, and they were squarely within a policy target range for rural revitalization. And this is where government support is coming in to support improved technological adoption, everything from processing, you know, we're talking about fruits and teas and agricultural produce, processing and packaging and warehousing, but importantly, building the e-commerce network to Southeast Asia. And so in a remarkably short period of time, these enterprises had gone from, you know, abject poverty and just doing something, you know, to meet the basic requirements, to then, you know, a springboard to sell products on e-commerce platforms overseas and using open source AI models, et cetera. So I think the population is a major, a key factor that affects how companies need to think about growth. But the constraints mean that consumers will pay differently, value things differently. And I think it's also worth noting the premium that has always been there for Western brands is also changing. I mean, it's changing. It's changed already in China. I think there are some brands that consumers find desirable, but there's been a rise of domestic brands. And I think particularly since COVID, there's also been a shift in the perception of luxury. And I think the premium luxury segment is declining in terms of its cachet with a wider population.
I think what I'm hearing is that Western brands were able to enter with almost a premium cachet just from being Western or just by being foreign.
Yes.
And that has slowly been eroding.
Consistently, yes.
Yes. Okay. And that, would you say, is due to really an incredible, you know, amount of brand loyalty, brand reputation that has been built from local, where it is more respected?
It's multiple factors. Of course, the perception of quality and safety is the foundation. And I can remember 10, 15 years ago, not that long ago, when you would go to the border and the villages in Hong Kong or around the border with Lo Wu in Shenzhen, and there'd be streams of, you know, mainland Chinese coming over to buy Hong Kong products because they had the reputation of being safe and higher quality. And then there was a period of currency arbitrage where things in Hong Kong actually became cheaper as the renminbi was getting stronger. But now it's quite the reverse. And Hong Kong people are going over to Shenzhen to get better service, higher quality meals and entertainment at a fraction of the cost. So it cuts both ways. But I think it was not until, you know, I mean, talking about Chinese products in particular, that consumers felt that they were of an equal or higher quality and safety, and there were standards, that things started to shift. And there's been, of course, you know, many, many sad examples of tainted products over the years. But when I go to China now, and particularly when we did this agricultural product project last year, you know, the quality, the packaging, the branding, the perception is on par with things you'd find in Japan. And that's actually surprising even to hear myself say that. So I think there's a baseline. And then we have to understand that people would prefer, you know, to have pride in their own products and consume locally if they can find things. And others in the region, their perception. So Southeast Asia's perception of Taiwan, of Korea, of Japan, and now China is continually changing. And dare I say, I think many of the products coming out of Japan and Korea have a greater premium and desire for customers in Southeast Asia than those from Europe.
You have facilitated field projects across 15 countries. And I think you mentioned some of that rural urbanization. We're talking Vietnam's, and I might butcher this, Dien Bien province.
Oh, Dien Bien is very famous. That's where the Dien Bien Phu
was. I'm glad
the
I didn't butcher
battle.
It.
You didn't butcher it. That's the famous battle where the French lost Vietnam before the Americans came in. Dien Bien Phu.
So from there to the, you know, Sichuan province, what have you learned from the on the ground work? And it's not that simple of a question. What have you learned that contradicts what you read in research reports or business school case studies, perhaps previous to getting that on the ground experience?
Well, it's a very complex question. Things are moving so fast.
What did they get wrong in school?
A lot. So much. Where to start? But things are moving so fast now, especially in China, that it's almost almost impossible to produce a report of inequality with human editorial and research that is not going to be outdated rather quickly. One of the examples, and I don't want to just use China examples, because actually the majority of our work has been in Southeast Asia and India and even in the Middle East. But one example to your point, 2 years ago, we did a project on EV battery recycling. And there was a lot of noise about the coming tsunami of EV batteries because of just the rapid scale up of China's production. And it all came true. And there would have been reports about the coming deluge of EV batteries. But by the time we got there, and this was mid-2024, again, the group was eager to understand the emerging opportunities for battery recycling, repurposing, extracting. And by that time, China had already had an oversupply of battery recycling factories. There had been so much investment into this sector anticipating that they could not get enough secondary batteries to recycle. So it was any report that came out talking about the future of battery recycling, et cetera, was already behind the game. So I think speed is one factor. There's a lot of intangible factors that data it just can't capture. And it's the human element in all of these massive cities, you know, how people are organizing themselves in Jakarta, you know, just to get to and from work, spending, you know, hours in traffic jam, the street level economy that's thriving, you know, in the kampongs. So I think the human element is very difficult to capture in these kind of business reports. But ultimately, that's where the sentiment changes. That's where decisions are being made.
Living there for 8 years. Okay, so just startup ecosystem. You would have something like TechCrunch, very famous media in the whole Silicon Valley world. They'd have a guy come out. He would land in Beijing, run around, come down to Shanghai, maybe go out to Hangzhou, you know, Alibaba, maybe hit Shenzhen, do the whole Guangdong region or something, hit up WeChat, and then 2 weeks and go back and write this really, you know, really lengthy op-ed on the entire ecosystem. Because, and it was just, it was so cringe. It was so bad. It was just like, absolutely.
But what was bad? What was bad about it? I mean, when I want to probe a little bit of what was cringeworthy about it.
Well, they only met with some creme de la creme of certain companies, whether it was like Xiaomi or I don't know, like, you know, Alibaba, like I said, some of these things, getting in with Weixin or Tencent, I should say. You know, but they were fed what I would consider a lot of startup propaganda, that they weren't telling them what was going on. They were telling them what they wanted them to say or write. And that you knew it wasn't always true, and how difficult it actually was to raise money. And the failure rate of startups was no better than it ever was in any other place, and that it was still just as much of a struggle. And, you know, it sent waves of, it was almost like a gold rush of just, you know, in 2012, startups were just coming over to China thinking it was the land. It was just this, you know, and they would get eaten alive. And I felt terrible that they weren't well prepped and they weren't well taken care of. And they were sent back with their tail between their legs, potentially to never be an entrepreneur again.
So I think this speaks to a fundamental challenge. You asked about the limitations of business reports, business school curricula, et cetera. And now, of course, AI generated insights. I think the tendency has always been to extrapolate from a few cases and then present the narrative around opportunities. And just as you mentioned, the incentives for those who want to promote a particular model have distorted the whole field. And extrapolating from a few of the sort of gold star cases, it just doesn't paint a useful picture. And I think this story is playing out right across the region, again, because of the scale.
Well, and there was, like you said, the human component. And I found that more often, a lot of Chinese were better entrepreneurs. They were hungrier. They came from less. They expected less. They were willing to work longer and harder and were more humble. The caveat to that was that they had, you know, the guanxi, the saving face. So where I think, you know, the West is a little bit better at failing and iterating and pivoting and then skinning up a new experiment and trying again and doing that repeatedly. They weren't afraid to fail, where it was somewhat taboo to fail in some Asian cultures. So they would kind of code in stealth and build in stealth. And then they had their one shot they would release. And if it flopped, well, game over. So a little bit different in that regard, but.
I think that's accurate. I think that is still a barrier to entrepreneurship, particularly in more advanced economies. I think Hong Kong struggles with this as an extremely financialized economy with an extremely high cost of living, very tight labor market and tight living arrangements. And therefore, these are all disincentives for entrepreneur mindset. And I think this is also the case in Singapore and is becoming the case in other financial centers.
Agreed. Okay, moving on, because you've written about pricing, consumption patterns, labor structures, and they succeed elsewhere but fail in Asia. So I want to talk about that. Maybe you can walk us through, you know, some of what you've written and talked about, and maybe a specific example where pricing or consumption assumptions led a company astray.
Well, I don't know if I want to name any specific companies. I think there are assumptions that are commonplace. Just to kind of paint a picture of the difference in pricing and labor markets. And I think also what you didn't mention, but is often something that we write about, is the externalized costs of the business model, which are felt very strongly in this region because, again, of the large populations and the limited land and resources. So again, plastic waste. I did a project in East Java and Bali on solutions for the plastic waste crisis. And make no mistake, it is a crisis. All you have to do is ask your GPT about the numbers of millions of tons of plastic produced. And
is it water bottles? Is that the number one?
Yes, that's a big one. But PET bottles are actually in high demand. And in many countries are going into mechanical recycling facilities. So those are not the biggest culprits. It's HDPE, LDPE. These are the different forms. These are your, you know,
types
unusually
of plastic.
Unusually formed types of hard, rigid plastics. Then the films. Actually, a big source of microplastics is in fibers. So, you know, I'm dismayed to say that even, you know, our suits and your shirts are made with a certain percentage of polyester or plastic derived, petrochemical derived fiber. And that is pervasive. So plastic waste, but millions and millions of tons mismanaged, going into the ocean, going into the food chain. So coming to pricing and labor, a team we worked with produced a very innovative concept of how to separate the useful recyclable plastic from the organic waste in Bali, which is a place where you have many traditional festivals. There's a lot of organic material in the offerings, and it's an island, so there's just a lot of cuttings. But over the last 20 years, more and more packaged goods have come in because of tourism, the hotels, the infrastructure, and it's all mixed up and you can't do anything with it. And there's just many small informal dumping grounds. How do you incentivize the village collection systems to separate the organic and the inorganic? Turns out, actually, a subsidy of only about 50 cents per kilogram of organic compost will incentivize villagers to separate that. And then you can actually create clean downstream funnels of plastic that can be recycled. And 50 cents seems like a small amount. But in order to do that, the proposal was also to add a $2 surcharge to a hotel room for international visitors who come. And of which there's, I think, within the association we worked with, something like 2,500 to 3,000 hotel rooms and $2 a night. And so you can actually arbitrage, you know, the tourist money coming in with a very small surcharge that would then fund the subsidy to separate the waste. And then downstream, there needs to be investment in the infrastructure. But people overestimate labor markets because they see top line numbers of countries growing, the GDP growing. Actually, the labor markets are still very, very low, and particularly in rural areas, in second, third, fourth tier cities. And so these are not, I think, always understood. But equally, the need to develop the skills, the organizational management, the sort of a mindset for producing quality, and just a lot of the operational work upskilling is still significant.
You've been vocal about ethical, human-centric deployment of AI technologies.
Yes.
And we dabbled a little bit talking about AI. Now, given that much of the research and analysis about Asia is, unfortunately, now AI generated or AI filtered or AI produced, how should businesses think about using AI tools to understand Asian markets?
Well, I think firstly, a healthy dose of skepticism and independent thought and critical thinking is necessary.
Going to be needed.
And it's easier said than done, perhaps. So skepticism. And then there's no substitute for ground truthing. And I think, unfortunately, the faster things appear to be, and what I refer to frequently as a time compression, because the AIs seem to be so efficient at generating so much insight and so much material, we expect everything very fast. It actually affects our perception. So there's a time compression. And then what this does is it reduces the ability to step back and reflect, and also diminishes the sense that I need to go and actually spend a few weeks being on the ground and talking to people in the markets that I care about. And I think that is a dangerous tendency, far, you know, well beyond, but more subtle than the synthetic dangers or the dangers of synthetic images and deep fakes and even AI slop, which now many companies are dealing with. And that is certain members of the team, often junior members who are inexperienced, generating pages and pages of memos, reports that are just not useful because they're not grounded in any reality or understanding, the AI slop. But I think the more insidious danger that we should caution against is, because of time compression, the feeling that we can just sit and get all the insights we need and we don't go. So it does require ground truthing, and or at least, you know, having trusted colleagues and partners in these countries who can provide an honest assessment. And that's also tricky because there is still an underlying discomfort and power differential whereby many individuals within the markets might not want to vocalize bad news or speak something directly to a counterpart or a supervisor in North America or Europe. And so because of that power differential and that tendency, those bosses don't always get the accurate insights that they need. So these are just some parts of the dilemma.
Yeah. Could not agree more. Like, full stop. That was great. You wrote in the South China Morning Post that reinvention must start now if Hong Kong businesses are to survive change. It's a strong statement. What needs to change? And why is the urgency so high?
Yeah, and I don't think this is a particularly Hong Kong dilemma, but because I'm sitting in Hong Kong and writing for the South China Morning Post, of course, they want to know. I think there's three major pillars of change drivers that business leaders need to come to terms with and invest time, which then, if not understood, present existential threats to the business. The first is geopolitics and the unraveling of the stable international order, which we just talked about. And that is playing out in everything from supply chain risk and the costs to recalibrate to energy price shocks, which, you know, I was in the Philippines a couple of weeks ago and clients and friends there are already spending a few days at home, being asked to conserve power, turn off lights, don't drive your cars. And, you know, it looks like things may have calmed down. We hope so. But I don't think that the tension around energy control is going to go away. And so these energy shocks, part of geopolitics, present a fundamental threat. The other, of course, is technology. And much has been written, and by much more qualified people than me, talking about the threat to legacy business models and the incumbents by generative AI-powered insurgents. I think the consulting industry is the one that's been most in the news that I've seen over the last couple of weeks, whereby the hourly pricing model breaks down when you have LLMs that are doing a lot of the slide deck production and even the reasoning and analysis far faster. So how can you bill at such extortionate rates as the senior partners when they're actually probably outsourcing some of that to LLMs as well? But there are many other examples about the risk of technology disrupting. And then the one that has actually taken a bit of a backseat, but is by far the biggest, and that is the existential threat of a changing climate and a tightening resource base, which will fundamentally break many business models because they have relied on essentially underpriced and even free resources, foremost water, land, clean air, et cetera. And the UN put out a report a few weeks ago that put front and center that we are no longer in an era of water risk or water stress. They're calling it water bankruptcy. So just go and check out the numbers and the prospects around water bankruptcy. And then any business that has been reliant on underpriced or free, essentially, water resources, watersheds, they're going to need to rethink. So again, this is not a Hong Kong dilemma, but it's also hitting Hong Kong in some interesting ways vis-a-vis a financialized economy.
The water thing is interesting. That really came up here in North America recently. Idaho announced a state of emergency.
Yeah, well, I'm from Southern California and I have friends in Arizona, Nevada, and I've watched this whole debacle around the Colorado River water sharing. And now I understand Las Vegas is facing, you know, acute water crisis. Maybe they have to turn off the fountains for a while. I don't know.
Well, I mean, Idaho's particular problem is mostly because of Kevin O'Leary's, what did he put in? Massive server farms for all his AI that was allowed. That was the whole thing. Yeah. So this is
a tension that seems obvious, but somehow just gets brushed under the rug in media, and then that filters in through the AI bots. But how is it that we're going to continue to scale up data centers and energy in the face of water crisis and a society that is actually already pushed to the breaking point, and then suggesting that they may have to pay more for energy. This is a problem in North America, but it's actually playing out in many parts of the world. Malaysia, where we do a lot of work and I have an office, is going through a similar dilemma with lots of incentives for building data centers and data infrastructure, but then, you know, tensions and conflict with water, land, agricultural resources.
Okay, last question. For a Western business that's serious about operating credibly, sustainably in Asian markets, your advice, what is their first step? And if they can only do one thing differently from what they're already doing, what should it be?
The first step is somewhat obvious, maybe, and might sound simplistic, but I think many business leaders need to be more humble and more open and curious to genuinely learn rather than assume that they know best because they read the HBR report or they did a degree at Stanford or Oxford or something. Okay, so a bit of humility and recognition that things are changing so fast. We're all on a learning curve. Actually, curiosity and a learning mindset is a superpower now. More practically, if businesses are already operating across different regions, then prioritize building management muscle locally in those markets. And don't discount that because you maybe feel that it can be managed from a distance. And I think this is actually a trend. Regional management layers at many clients we work with have been restructured out of existence over the last few years since the pandemic. And I think the danger of this is losing local management talent that are empowered to make decisions based on, again, the regionalization. And there seems to be a trend towards this global integration of business units where ultimately decision makers are sitting in Canada, the US or Europe or in Japan. And we work with many Japanese clients. So I think this is dangerous. And it comes to the need to feel the pulse on the ground where you're operating. And there's no substitute for doing that. And what I call ground truthing, but also building local management teams.
There's no VR app in the world that's going to replace being on the actual ground, touching the dirt and touching the grass. No question. This has been amazing. For our listeners who want to learn more about GIF's work or follow your writing, where do they find you?
Well, you can find us at global-inst.com. That's our website. We're also on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. We have a newsletter. You can sign up for our newsletter. And we'd love to talk with you if you're ever coming through Hong Kong.
Yeah, just ask Claude.
Hong Kong or KL. Hong Kong or KL.
Hi.
Malaysia.
How do I find Eric Streisand? And then Claude will tell you.
I think he might. I'm not sure what he will say, but
that he might get that one right. Bang on.
I'm sure he would get much of that right. But the nuance is still questionable.
Eric, thanks very much for coming on the show and being a part of this with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Eric. And thanks to you, everybody who's listening and I'm sure rushing over to hit that subscribe button. It's rather innocuous. I know everybody just streams at this point and you don't need the weight of everything downloaded on your phone, but please just maybe a little hit the button, maybe make us your favorite. It does help the algorithms feed it to other people who might want to digest and learn from this content. But from me, from Eric, and everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation. And if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co. And be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.